Hello, hello, hello. Welcome to Be Bold America. I'm your host, Jill Cody, along with my co-host, Dr. Pettus Perry. Hey, Pettus, how are you today?
I'm doing really well, Jill. I hope the same for you.
I'm doing great. And so let's get right to our program. I'm very excited about this. Our program today, are state houses being weaponized against democracy? Our guest says we have a larger problem than Donald Trump's big lie. David Pepper's book, Laboratories of Autocracy, A Wake-Up Call from Behind the Lines, illustrates that far more than the high-profile antics of D.C. politicians like Marjorie Taylor Greene or Jim Jordan, that there is an even bigger challenge to American democracy. It is the anonymous, often corrupt politicians in state houses across the country who pose the greatest dangers to American democracy. But David Pepper doesn't stop there. He lays out a robust pro-democracy agenda outlining how everyone from elected officials to everyday citizens can fight back. Our future depends on it. Pettus, would you like to introduce our guest today?
It'd be my pleasure. In addition to writing four novels, our guest today, David Pepper, is the author of Laboratories of Democracy.
Autocracy.
A Wake-Up Call from Behind the Lines. David earned his BA from Yale University and his JD from Yale Law School. Prior to law school, David worked in St. Petersburg, Russia, for the Washington-based Center for Strategic and International Studies. Vital to today's topic, David served as chairman of the Ohio State Democratic Party from 2015 to 2021. David also clerked for a judge on the United States Court of Appeals, served in local elected office in Ohio, worked for major law firms, and teaches election and voting rights law. And by the way, his whiteboard lectures on his Laboratories of Autocracy website are not to be missed. We have big things to do. Welcome to Be Bold America, David. I think I had your voice in my head when I said democracy instead of autocracy.
Yeah. You know, thank you. It's great to be with you guys. And that happens a lot because I'm obviously playing off the old term that states are supposed to be these forces for good. Unfortunately, in too many places, they're not doing that right now.
Well, I'm so sorry, David, to bring you on the show when it's such a slow news week. Gosh, whatever will we talk about?
Exactly.
You know, all kidding aside, you worked in St. Petersburg, Russia, and Russia just started the first war in Europe since 1939 this week. And in Florida this week, the legislature advanced the Don't Say Gay bill. They also are passing legislation stating students can't be made to feel uncomfortable. What is happening in Florida State House is a perfect example of the content of your book. Your book is brilliant, by the way. To begin, why don't you tell us why you wrote Laboratories of Autocracy and what are some of your key points that we all should know about?
Sure, thank you very much. And yeah, I actually did work in Russia in the early 90s before I answered the question, and it really makes me doubly sad about what's happening because I got to know a lot of good Russian people in St. Petersburg, some Ukrainians, and it's just tragic what we're seeing, and let's all hope it comes to an end in a peaceful way as possible. But, you know, I wrote the book. I was chair of the Ohio Democratic Party. I've written actually several novels. And last year, as I watched what you just described in Florida happening in Texas and Ohio and other states around the country, and I just didn't get a sense that people were seeing it for really what it was. You know, we often have described what's happening in states about as attacks on voting rights, and that's that as if, you know, that's bad already. But when you start looking at all the different things happening in these state houses, and this is when I started writing the book, you're seeing a much broader-based assault on basic democratic norms and principles. You know, everything from voting rights to rigging of districts so people in power never lose, attacking courts, attacking constitutional amendments that were passed by the people. And you start to add it up, and it actually, it's not very dissimilar from countries that have fallen into autocracy. And that's why I call the book, you know, there is the old saying that states act as laboratories of democracy, and that's happened sometimes. But these states, one of the thesis of the book, these states have huge amounts of power over our lives, over democracy. But the problem is almost no one really knows what happens in state houses. So in the wrong hands, they can actually do some very negative things. While people are all paying attention to Washington, D.C. or, you know, Mar-a-Lago or something. And so the book is walking through how many of these states have begun, over the last more than a decade ago, to really start not just doing traditional legislation issues, but along with some very conservative approaches on policymaking, have also been working to undermine democracy itself so that they can never lose power. And that's really accelerated in the last 5 years. You know, I'll just stop with this. A lot of people say, well, the big lie led to all this. This all preceded the big lie. This has been happening since about 2011, and it's accelerating. It's the downward spiral. And the whole point of my book was, the second half of the title is A Wake-Up Call from Behind the Lines. It's to try and wake people up that if you really care about democracy, it's not just about voting in federal elections or trying to win the presidency. It's about getting good people into office at all levels, including state houses and local, because that's where so much of the democracy of this country is shaped.
Well, you have a very good example in your book and the video on your website about Manchester, Ohio. Can you tell us that story? Because I think it's really an excellent example of what you're talking about.
Sure. So one reason, so Manchester is a little town about 60 miles east of where I'm sitting, which is Cincinnati, and it's on the river, on the Ohio River. And, you know, oftentimes when people, and I'm a Democrat, I'll acknowledge that, but my whole point in my book is to say, this is about democracy, which is bigger than one party. And we all need to unify everyone who cares about democracy around lifting it up again, because it's in such danger right now. And I try and tell the story about Manchester to explain that the attacks on democracy in states, where you literally have in many states, essentially at the state house level, there's not a lot of functioning democracy left. I mean, these state houses, the word is gerrymandering. That's where they draw their own districts so they can never lose them. These districts are so one-sided and so gerrymandered, there's no accountability. And I tell the story of Manchester because this is a typical small town in Ohio that's completely dying. You know, the main street is empty. The jobs have been leaving. Young people are leaving. The population's declining. When I walk in Manchester, as I do on that video, it looks like a ghost town. The people of that, and that's all happening because of policies, trickle-down economics, you know, tax breaks at the high end, paid for by you know, revenues for cities like Manchester. It just isn't working for most places. It might work for a small number of people, but most places are suffering under this defund government, trickle-down economic approach. Well, that's why Manchester, the main reason it's doing so poorly, when the people of Manchester called their state senator to their town and asked for a meeting to say to him, hey, look what's happening. Our town is dying. How will you help us? His answer, as I put in the book and on my video, is sometimes you just have to move. And I use that example because it's such a glaring example where in these state houses where these districts are so rigged that these politicians can never lose their election, they're so confident that they won't lose that they'll tell their own constituents that the constituents should move, as opposed to maybe they need to come up with better solutions to the problems. And that just shows you how much things are reversed in today's politics, where instead of the voters saying to a politician, hey, you failed, it's time for you to move, the politician says to the voter, no, you move. And that's what's happening. In so many states like Ohio, there literally is no choice left in politics. And so people can generate the most abysmal public outcomes on healthcare, to schools, infrastructure, and there's nothing that the citizens can do about it because every election is predetermined. And that's part of the sort of laboratory autocracy model and theme I walk through in the book. And I give a lot of examples of this in a lot of different states.
Well, I think I heard you say, I don't know if it was in the video or one of the videos, that you thought Ohio isn't a Democratic state anymore.
It is hard to define. It's hard to define these states where literally 98% of the elections are predetermined by the shaping of these districts, which happens every 10 years, and then very aggressive voter suppression. So that, you know, in states like Ohio, Wisconsin, Pennsylvania, Michigan, You know, in 18, for example, a majority of the voters of Michigan and Pennsylvania, Wisconsin, about 50-50 in Ohio, voted for a Democrat to be in the state house. In Wisconsin, it was like 9 points. They preferred a Democrat or Republican. But the rigging of the legislative districts in Wisconsin is so extreme that even a majority voting for a Democrat for the Wisconsin State House led to a supermajority in a state house of Republicans. Basically, they drew districts so extreme in terms of predetermining the outcomes that even when the majority said, we want something different, they stayed in power. It's really hard at that point to say that this is sort of a functioning, viable democracy. That's a lot more like, you know, lately in the news we hear about Hungary, which is a system that Donald Trump and Tucker Carlson like. That's what Hungary has, a system where no matter what the voters do, the legislature always looks the same. That's what's happened in a lot of states here. And what we learned over the last 10 years is once these politicians understand they can never be replaced, even when the voters don't like them, they start acting in all sorts of really warped ways. It's almost the opposite of what we would expect in a normal functioning democracy. So, no, it's hard to really look at the last 10 years in some of these states. Now, statewide elections, some of them at least, are still, you know, pretty toss-up. But the state houses, where so much power rests, are essentially locked up by one side, and even when the voters don't agree with them, they have very little ability to change those outcomes. So it's hard to define them as a functioning democracy in a lot of these places.
And one of the things is that overlay of all of this are the anti-voter laws, a fire hose of these anti-voter laws as well. Kristen Mason, I think, who was in Texas, got 5 years in prison for voting a mistake because she was on parole. The same thing happened to Pamela Moses. 6 years in prison. I think she was from Tennessee. Yet there have been proven dozens of white people voted for Trump and illegally, and none were sent to prison. Of course, Kristen and Pamela were African American.
Right. There's been a pretty brutal types of prosecution for voting mistakes on one side. I mean, we've seen that. I mean, people went to jail for years. Sometimes over some violation they were unaware of, or in Ohio we had a couple people. I don't think they ended up in real prosecutions, but they voted by mail. They weren't sure if their vote, you know, was ultimately counted because the mail system was screwed up. So they went in to vote in person, and the system caught it. It's not like their vote ever counted twice, but they're treated like, you know, serious criminals for a mistake. And then on the flip side, you see people doing what you just described, some really bad things, purposely doing it, and it's sort of skewed. And, you know, one of the, in adding a huge amount, you know, so bigger picture, one of the things they've done in the last 10 years is really trump up this suggestion of voter fraud on a mass scale. It's just not accurate. There are, every election, there are dozens probably in a state of instances of the kind of things we've talked about. Sometimes, obviously, if intentional, there should be some accountability. Other times, it's just innocent mistakes. It didn't change anything. But the backdrop of voter fraud is a huge way in which they've justified, you know, cracking down on voters that's led to, you know, tens of thousands or hundreds of thousands of voters being disenfranchised or knocked off the rolls or not being able to vote because they didn't have some updated ID, to account for the fact that in the past election, 30 people voted the wrong way or did break the law. So the overcompensation is this blunt force instrument that's knocking far more people off the ability to vote than the actual underlying problem. It's just one of the many things they're doing like that.
It's infuriating. And it's just time to take a break and do some station ID. You're listening to Be Bold America on KSQD 90.7 FM. Many voices, one station. Listen globally online from the KSQD.org website. We're speaking with David Pepper, Yale Law School's graduate, author of Laboratories of Autocracy, author of three political thrillers, one of which I just finished last night, David. The first one, The People's House, with a new one being published this year, and former chairman of the Democratic Party of Ohio. Visit laboratoriesofautocracy.com to learn more. I'm your host, Jill Cody.
Hello, K-Squid listeners. I'm Todd Hartman, and each weekday at 4 p.m., I bring you a different perspective on the news than you're likely to hear on most media outlets. Please join me on KSQD Santa Cruz, your ink spot on the dial for the Tom Hartman program, heard now for the first time ever in the Monterey Bay Area at 90.7 FM, weekdays at 4 p.m. That's Progressive Talking Conversation with me, Tom Hartman, weekdays at 4 p.m. on KSQD 90.7 FM. Tag, you're it.
If you're just joining us, our topic today is, are state houses being weaponized against democracy? We're speaking with David Pepper, author of Laboratories of Autocracy, a wake-up call from behind the lines. At David's website, laboratoriesofautocracy.com, you'll find numerous two-minute fabulous video tutorials. Please go check them out. Pettis, I've kind of hogged David a little bit. I'll toss it
to
you.
That's okay, Jill. That's quite all right. It's a fascinating discussion, Dave and Jill. I'm one that likes history, and I always try to understand, you know, the cycle of events, because what we're experiencing today has probably happened previously. And one of the things I found interesting was your discussion of Reconstruction and that period, and how each time there's some form of democratic progress, the other side turns to trying to undermine that, up to it, and using the Supreme Court. Would you mind talking a little bit about that and the Southern strategy?
Sure. It's really a sobering part of our history. It's one of the things that actually drives me to keep talking about this every single day, which I appreciate you inviting me. The history of our country, in several different ways, could not be more clear, and the lesson needs to be learned. And this is often why it's so troubling, people try and censor our history. Whenever in the past states have been relentlessly attacking democracy, which one of the points of the book is states have an enormous power over democracy. They write a lot of the rules of how our elections are run. They draw the district lines for Congress and their state houses. They do control some of the electoral college process. In the past, and the best example of this is what led to Jim Crow after the Civil War, when states attack democracy itself, as they're doing right now, unless there is a hard pushback from those who care about a diverse democracy, those attacks succeed. And they can succeed not just for a few years, but generations. And there is so much parallel to what happened in the late 1800s and now. It should scare everybody. So after the Civil War, you know, black vote, newly freed black slaves were able to vote in the South. And they voted actually very big numbers. In some states, like Louisiana, there were more black voters than white voters. And there were hundreds of thousands of voters in Alabama and South Carolina. And those voters were electing people, it's a forgotten part of our history. They were actually electing a very diverse group of elected officials. They were, you know, black state house members and speakers and sometimes majorities. They were black members of Congress, lieutenant governors, Supreme Court justices, all over the South. But as also is true in our history, and we saw this after Obama won, there's also a very, very scary history in our country that whenever a diverse majority sort of exerts its will through democracy, there's a fierce backlash. And that backlash was very clear in the late 1800s when black voters were getting elected into office, a diverse group of officials who then shaped policy. There was this immediate push that built and built of, well, there's voter fraud. We have to get these black voters off the rolls through poll taxes and literacy tests. That was accompanied by violence. As you said, the Supreme Court of the United States, despite the 14th and 15th Amendment, allowed a lot of those new state laws to stay in place. By 1900, the 140,000 or so registered voters of Louisiana I mentioned was down to about 700, thanks to those measures. And within a few years, all those black elected officials were no longer in office because there were no more black voters voting. And so the lesson is that there is this fierce backlash that is triggered when you have diverse majorities voting in America. It's sad, but it couldn't be more clear if you look at the history. You mentioned it after the Civil Rights Movement, sort of finally after 80-plus years of Jim Crow, Civil Rights Movement pushes again in the 60s and 70s to have a more diverse electorate. We see the Southern strategy to try and change that. Obama wins in 2008. What happens 3 years later? Clamping down on early vote, purging of voters, voter ID. It's a very similar theme. And of course, after Biden wins, with a whole lot of black voters stepping up and voting in big numbers in Atlanta, Philadelphia, Detroit, we see a crackdown again. You know, drop boxes or however black people are voting is how they ultimately decide which mechanisms of voting to cut down upon. Now, there wasn't fraud or drop boxes or early vote. It's simply like the 1800s, if the side they view as the threat to their power, which happens to be the diverse side, is voting a certain way, it always seems that that's how the voting is cracked down on. So it's a very sobering history, and we should learn the lesson. And the most important lesson is that the people who are sort of attacking this diverse democracy, they're always there. The question is, are those fighting for democracy fighting fiercely? When those people fight fiercely, then democracy normally prevails. If those people who are fighting for democracy cut deals or don't fight as hard or let other things distract them, as happened in the late 1800s, the side that's attacking democracy wins. And we are at one of those moments. At this moment, the Voting Rights Act has been weakened. The Supreme Court is doing damage to voter rights. These districts are being gerrymandered. The side that cares about democracy has to start fighting a lot harder, or I worry that we will enter another era where democracy is really sort of subordinated in a way that we just can't afford to let that happen again like it did a century ago.
Now, David, go ahead, Pettis.
No, I was just saying that seems to me to be happening. I have another question, if you don't mind, Joel.
Sure.
One of the things that I'm curious about is the sunsetting of voting rights and how every, I don't know what the period is, maybe you can help us understand, we have to reaffirm voting rights for people, which is one of the areas I think is very problematic. What is that system, and is it possible to change that system so that voting rights are unquestioned going forward?
Hold on one second. When they initially passed the Voting Rights Act, a feature was to reauthorize. And that's led to, decades where every few years we had to reauthorize the Voting Rights Act. But what was interesting was for years, for decades, reauthorizing the Voting Rights Act, in the end, was unquestioned. You know, Ronald Reagan, George Bush reauthorized the Voting Rights Act, and it was passed by overwhelming bipartisan margins in the Senate, 95-5 or something, that kind of number. And it was only after the Supreme Court really weakened the Voting Rights Act about a decade ago that all of a sudden people stopped in a bipartisan way saying they should support the Voting Rights Act. And we are still stuck in that world right now. So, what I would say, if they are able, and the Senate needs to do this, they have the ability right now, if it weren't for a couple Democratic senators insisting on the filibuster being an obstacle, which is an absurd thing to do, I agree that they should pass something that doesn't require reauthorization. It is time to lock it in. And we have learned this lesson. If you don't keep fighting for voting rights, they can disappear very quickly. And we are right now, there are voters all across this country paying the price for the Supreme Court weakening the Voting Rights Act. But the truth is, there is in Congress bills right now, the John Lewis Act, the Freedom to Vote Act, they would bring a lot more robust protection back into the Voting Rights Act and correct for the Supreme Court's rulings. And they're just, while almost all Democrats voted for them, several are holding it up on the filibuster, and that is keeping the protection from being back in place. But that doesn't excuse, by the way, and I don't want to offend your audience. I don't know who listens to your show. But the real fault here is the Republicans who, again, for generations, mean, Ronald Reagan, Strom Thurmond, the Southern segregationist, supported the New Voting Rights Act when we were brought up. So why in the world not a single Republican will support the Voting Rights Act in 2022 when these were supported by almost every Republican for decades is just inexcusable. And I do think, though, to your question, it's time to not make this something that we have to sort of refight. It needs to be locked in as a permanent protection because, as I explained earlier, there is always a force in this country pushing against democracy. And so we shouldn't leave it in the balance whether or not we re-up the Voting Rights Act every few years. We just need to lock it in as permanent law and frankly, always be perfecting it and making it as strong as possible. So the only revotes I would have would be make it stronger and stronger and stronger as we watch how people attack voting rights.
I always say democracy is a verb. You know, it's action, and it's not static. And I do have a question for you, and if I can just set it up quickly here. And it's about Rick Scott's Restore America 11-point plan. Now, Rick Scott came from a state, and his plan is really is a blueprint for what states could be doing in the future. You know, it's a plan that lists grievance and nonsense, and there's no rigor behind it, and it's just written as ideology. And I loved, I heard Steve Schmidt say that it was meant to tickle the erogenous zones of Fox News viewers. I thought that was great. And when you read it, it just sounds like it's crackpot, you know, and it's black and white, but it's really currently state legislation is happening with it. For example, they talk about election fraud and using CRT to not teach racism in school, and men are men and women are women, and unborn babies are babies. And the one, number seven, which really got me was today's Democrat Party, not Democratic Party, but today's Democrat Party is trying to rig elections and pack the courts because they've given up on democracy. They don't believe they can win based on their ideas, so they want to game the system and legalize voter fraud to stay in power. In true Orwellian fashion, Democrats refer to their election rigging plans as voter rights. We won't allow the radical left to destroy our democracy by institutionalizing dishonesty and fraud. That one really got me. But I wanted to get your input on Rick Scott's 11-point plan, because Mitch McConnell's, when he was asked, what will you do if you take over the House and Senate in 2022? And he says, I'll let you know after we're elected. But here's Rick Scott's plan filling that void. What are your thoughts, David?
Yeah, you know, it's funny. I mean, Mitch McConnell is sort of the probably the wiser of the two, but Rick Scott's plan also shows it. You know, one of the things I put in my book is most of the ideas that are coming out of the Republican Party, most of them are minority view ideas. Like 20 or 30% of the country agrees with them. That's why Mitch McConnell doesn't want to reveal his agenda. He knows that actually if it's laid out there, people won't agree with it. Rick Scott, in a way, give him credit, he at least publicized a whole lot of ideas, like, you know, adding a tax on, I think, at least half of America.
Everyone.
And making less money. Yeah.
Income tax down to the poor. You know, they're already paying sales tax and other things, but less tax for the rich and income tax down to everyone.
Right. And you know, whether it's attacking Roe v. Wade, doing nothing about climate change, whether it's, you know, not wanting to do any common sense gun laws, gun reform laws, gun safety laws, their set of ideas are generally very unpopular. And the reason in my book I say they go through state houses, they get most of their ideas accomplished through state houses because in state houses people don't know what's going on. And even if they do, they can't do anything about it because these state houses have rigged gerrymandered districts. And so the reason they use state houses to accomplish trickle-down economics, you know, keep people from getting health care, attacking public schools, pushing through extreme gun laws that only 10% of even gun owners would agree with, like not having background checks. They can do that at state houses because that's where you can get unpopular things done. And the reason Mitch McConnell doesn't want to lay out an agenda at the national level is he knows that. the Koch brothers know that their agenda is actually not supported by the people. And that's why, in the end, you know, there are two sides right now in this battle in politics in America. One side is generally Democrats and others who actually try and get their ideas accomplished through elections in a stable democracy. The other side actually knows that its ideas are not supported by the general population. So they are actually attacking democracy itself, because they know that in a world of real elections where everyone votes, they would actually lose. And they would lose because, again, whether it's Roe v. Wade or things in Rick Scott's plan or you name it, what they're doing would actually not survive in real elections. People don't want what they want. They don't want trickle-down economics where most people are left out. That's a political loser. Like they don't want Rick Scott's tax plan. If they hear about it, they're like, no, I don't want that. So I do think that it kind of goes back to why it is that most of what they want to achieve, they're pushing through state houses, because that's where they can push those things and not get the political backlash they'll get if they try to do it.
Hence the title of your your book, Laboratories of Autocracy. You're listening to our bold guest, David Pepper, author of Laboratories of Autocracy, author of three political thrillers, and former chairman of the Democratic Party of Ohio. To learn more, visit laboratoriesofautocracy.com. In addition, if you'd like to be added to our news group, you may text Be Bold America to 22828. Text Be Bold America to 22828. And thank you to those who've done so already. It is so rewarding to see new people join our list. It just takes a second. I'm your host, Jill Cody.
Many Americans can't believe that political coups are part of our country's history. But consider the Wall Street Pooch of 1933. Never heard of it? It was a corporate conspiracy to oust Franklin Roosevelt, who had just been elected president. With the Great Depression raging and millions of families financially devastated, FDR had launched several economic recovery programs to help people get back on their feet. To pay for this crucial effort, he had the audacity to raise taxes on the wealthy, and this enraged a group of Wall Street multimillionaires. Wailing that their, quote, liberty to grab as much wealth as possible was being shackled, they accused the president of mounting a class war. To pull off their coup, they plotted to enlist a private military force made up of destitute World War I veterans who were upset at not receiving promised federal bonus payments. One of the multimillionaire's lackeys reached out to a well-respected advocate for veterans, retired Marine General Smedley Darlington Butler. They wanted him to lead 500,000 veterans in a march on Washington to force FDR from the White House. But they chose the wrong general. Butler was a patriot and lifelong soldier for democracy who in his later years was critical of corporate war profiteering, and he was repulsed by the hubris and treachery of these Wall Street aristocrats. He reached out to a reporter, and together they gathered proof to take to Congress. A special congressional committee investigated and found Butler's story, quote, alarmingly true, leading to public hearings with Smedley Darlington Butler giving detailed testimony. This is Jim Hightower saying, by exposing the traitors, this courageous patriot nipped their coup d'etat in the bud. But their sense of entitlement reveals that we must beware of the concentrated wealth of the imperious rich, for it poses an ever-present danger to your and my majority rule.
Welcome back. You're listening to Be Bold America on KSQD 90.7 FM, Many Voices, One Station. Listen globally online from the KSQD.org website. We are listening to our bold guest, David Pepper, author of Laboratories of Autocracy, and we're discussing how state houses across the country pose the greatest dangers to American democracy. Pettis, again, I was hogging David, so would you like to ask a question?
Why, thank you, my friend.
You're welcome.
Okay. David, I actually have a kind of a two-part question. The first is, you talk a lot about Ohio and what's happening in Ohio. Is Ohio particularly more corrupt than any of the other states, and are they violating any laws in their processes? Can you talk to us about that?
Yeah, I mean, again, I'm a big Ohio guy. I think we're one of the worst. USA Today did rank Ohio maybe about a year ago as the most corrupt state, although that's quite a, you know, cutthroat competition. So, there are laws being broken. I mean, we have a major corruption scandal happening now. A couple of years ago, we had a different one. The speaker resigned. What I try and explain in the book is you are going to get corruption, and it's all over the country. When you have a group of people who are in power with no accountability, they know they'll get reelected no matter what they do, and the private interests are sitting in those state capitals, pushing them to do certain things that are mainly about enriching them. Basically, the whole system is corrupted. Whether they do specific things like actual bribery, the entire broader MO of a lot of these state houses is a massive transfer of public assets and public resources into private hands. In Ohio, the most clear-cut example of that has been for-profit online charter school scams that have basically taken public school money and put them into these for-profit companies that claim to be educating kids at home virtually, even though in Ohio, the biggest of this type of company couldn't even prove the kids it claimed were actually students there. But you also see it in privatizing the energy grids in Texas, where people froze to death because the energy grid collapsed. You see it in poor infrastructure, trickle-down economics. So, you know, we have a big problem. A great state, I'm very proud of Ohio, has seen its public outcomes really disintegrate in the last 20 years under these broken state houses. But you see it all over the country. Part and parcel with these undemocratic state houses are a massive transfer of public wealth to the private players that have locked up these state houses. And so it's a problem everywhere. And it's not, again, going back to that Manchester, it's not only it doesn't only impact Democratic areas. It impacts everybody. Small towns that need infrastructure, need health care, need good public schools aren't getting any of those things, so they're collapsing quickly. Economics is leaving most people out, while a few people make out like bandits. Well, that's what these state houses are doing. So the corrupting influence of these broken state houses is really costing everyday people and everyday communities all over these states. And that's one of the ways, I think, if people want to try and prevail, they have to focus on what those costs really are to everybody. If you just yell about corruption and democracy, although I care about those things, a lot of people, they don't understand how that impacts their lives.
One thing. Okay, thanks. Thanks, Pettis. We're so excited to talk to you, David, that we're stepping all over each other. How do we save democracy after two decades of Fox News? I mean, the fire hose of falsehoods. And it's not just Fox. It's 1,500 right-wing radio stations. It's hundreds of right-wing TV stations. It's right-wing podcasters, an army of trolls on social media. They're all damaging democracy and elections. And you said Ohio, you know, has been slipping for two decades. And that's exactly how long Fox News has been on the air. What are your thoughts about this fire hose of falsehoods that are just permeating the country in all mediums?
Yeah, it's a big problem. And, you know, I think that the more, and you're doing it here with your show, and the more people can use social media and other ways, new media, podcasts, to try and fight back, the better. I also think people just we have to educate ourselves more on how we can all sort of discern. I mean, right now it's, you know, what was interesting was, to get back to Russia for a second, President Biden did a really good job of explaining, as Putin was trying to convince everyone about this false narrative that this was sort of a defensive attack, Joe Biden was calling it all out, and it didn't work. So I think we all have to be a lot about how do we proactively get the truth out there. Certain outlets dominate, but no, it's a big problem. And by the way, this takes me back to what I was just saying before. It's very hard to argue with so much bad information, especially when they co-opt sometimes. You know, you mentioned Rick Scott's plan. You would think that Democrats are the ones who are undermining democracy if you read his plan. or you listen to his speeches.
Right.
And that's why, it was Donald Trump who started saying fake news when he's the one who is lying about everything. So they'll kind of try and co-opt it so no one knows which way is up. And the reason I think it's so smart, if you want to look at the winning candidates, there's a Democratic candidate, there's a Democratic governor of Kansas, for example. How did she win? She didn't get caught into all these broader debates that are so charged. She said, and if you look her up, her name is Laura Kelly, she ran an election on one issue, and that was, why in the heck have we defunded our public education so much in Kansas that we only have 4 days of school per week? Why? Well, that was her campaign. And that is, when you start getting the everyday issues that really impact people, or Beto O'Rourke in Texas, what's he focusing on? Now, he could talk about all the corruption that led to this, but he's just like she could have in Kansas. What's Beto talking about? Why in the world in Texas did people freeze to death when that energy grid collapsed? Well, that's something that, again, Fox News won't talk about it. But once you start breaking these things down to how it impacts everyday people, and the outcomes are as bad as they are under these broken systems, I think that's when you can cut through some of the clutter. And people in Texas know that happened. And of course, people will try and spin their way out of it. But when these outcomes become so indefensible, I think at a certain point, it's the focus on them that really gets people paying attention who aren't as partisan, aren't thinking about politics every day, but in their own lives, the idea that school is down to 4 days a week is just outrageous enough to get them thinking, yeah, we got to fix that. So I think getting simple down to messages that people really in their own lives care about, even if they're not political, is one really good way to get to the nub of the problem and not find yourself spending half your time just debating misinformation.
Well, you're getting to one of my buttons, and that is the Democrats' messaging. I always ask, where's our Frank Luntz? that's
right.
I certainly am very aware of Frank Luntz and his focus groups and the talking points that come out of it and how they're able to manipulate the voter with all of his work. But I don't know that we have one. And do you think the Democrats are, how are they doing on messaging?
I mean, Joe Biden with, I think his Build Back Better was a way to sort of in a concrete way talk about what Democrats would do. So he got there some. I think in 2018, though, I think the Democrats really focused on healthcare in a way that was good messaging. It cut through so much else. Generally, the Republicans have just been more disciplined over the years about building a brand. When you hear the word Republican for a long time, it was, tough on crime, low taxes. Like, people really knew what they stood for. Democrats have had a harder time doing that. My view, and I've done some research on this when I was chair of the party, I think our best brand, our best thinking about who we are, what we stand for, if we really want to win elections, is we're the one, and this will sound like something that was a couple of decades ago, but also something that even was pushed not long ago. We're the, in a world where there are so many people going to bat for big corporations or other entities, we're the ones who have to be seen as putting everyday people first. People first. That's what FDR did. That's what Truman did. That's what we did with healthcare. And we have to somehow reclaim that. Because I think if people see us, Democrats, on issue to issue as the ones fighting for everyday people, I think that gets back to the roots of what people think the Democratic Party is. But I think too often we get spun up into many other things that take away from that very sort of people-oriented message. I think that generally we have not been as strategic about thinking about a brand. And we also, unlike Republicans, every candidate running has their own idea of a message or a brand, and that's fine. But unless everyone's kind of on the same page, it means that no one knows across the board what all these candidates stand for. And so I think that is something that needs to be done. Republicans, like you said, Frank Luntz and others, they think they're through this stuff every day. It's not an accident when all of a sudden they're all saying the same thing. They're really thinking about it they're doing the research. We have to think about message in that same way. And that's why in my book, you know, I go through case studies back to these public outcomes I talked about. The candidates who succeeded on the Democratic side of the last couple of years were the ones who generally got themselves really focusing on issues that matter to everyday people in their states: education, infrastructure, health care. And they would explain it in ways that didn't feel that partisan, but that you could imagine someone, a family sitting around the kitchen table thinking, yeah, why do we only have 4 days of school a week? What's happened to your state? Let's fix that. And I think that's part of the messaging discipline, is to get to those issues and not get spun up on every single issue that we, you know, there's what we care about when we message on. And sometimes I think Democrats lose sight of what the ultimate winning message is, which is sometimes these very bread and butter issues.
We're speaking with David Pepper, who is the author of Laboratories of Autocracy, A Wake-Up Call from Behind the Lines. You're listening to Be Bold America on KSQD 90.7 FM. Want a friend to hear this interview? Be Bold America is available as a podcast. Now you and your friends can listen for free on your favorite podcast platform, such as Apple, Google, Spotify, Radio Public, and many more. I'm your host, Jill Cody.
Join me for State of Mind, Being Human and Living Well, conversations about mental health and wellness here on the Central Coast. I'm your host, Deborah Sloss, licensed therapist, and I'll be joined by guests sharing their personal stories, their clinical expertise, and resources on a topic. Tune in to State of Mind, the first Sunday of the month, 6 to 7 p.m., right here on KSQD 90.7 FM.
Today, our topic is, are state houses being weaponized against democracy? We're speaking with David Pepper, author of Laboratories of Autocracy and former chairman of the Ohio State Democratic Party. Visit laboratoriesofautocracy.com to learn more. Now, David, normally in our last portion of the program, we ask our guests what we can keep doing, stop doing, and start doing to further your issue. However, you've done something similar in your book with your last four chapters, so I'd like to go through your ideas for action in that order. The chapter 11 was Reclaiming Democracy. Chapter 12 was Resistance at the National Level, then Resistance at the State Level, and Resistance at the Individual Level. So what can we do?
Well, the first thing, as I put in, is I said it earlier, one side is spending all its time thinking that we're just in a battle over federal elections. And if all we do is win some federal elections, presidency, Senate, House, that we win. The other side is actually playing a very different game. They understand that they will not win long-term in a strong democracy because their ideas aren't popular. So they're battling over democracy itself. So the first thing everyone has to do who cares about democracy is realize that's what the battle is. This is not simply a battle over winning federal seats. The battle is over democracy itself. And once you reclaim that as the battle, once you see it, that means you have to totally change your strategy so that you're not just fighting for the federal positions that you care about. You're fighting to win every state house in this country, because every state house shapes the democracy of this country. You're not just getting excited when there's a presidential election year. You're getting excited every year because school boards and state houses and other offices all shape democracy. You're also starting to redefine everything you do as part of a long-term strategy. You know, too often Democrats, we think it's the end-all, be-all. If we win some federal elections, we think we've won it all and we celebrate it's over. If we lose, it's woe is us, we lost everything. The other side, you know, look, Obama won in 08. We won everything in 08, Democrats did. Did that stop Karl Rove from fighting to win every state house he could in 10? No, he kept going. Just like after Biden won Virginia in 2020, they turned right around and won the governor's house the next year in Virginia. We have to see it all as a long game that's building towards democracy, the way suffragists saw it for women voters, the way civil rights heroes saw it. And my best example of a long game thinking was how Stacey Abrams, she took on the battle of turning Georgia into a much more robust democracy as a long-term battle. She did it for years and years and years. And even when she didn't win the governor's race in 18, she knew she had made progress. 2 years later, Georgia, you know, really saves the country from Donald Trump. So once you rethink it all as democracy itself, it really changes everything you do in politics. So that's point one. Point two is the federal government needs to step up. As I said, in the past, if states are attacking democracy, the federal government has an obligation to protect democracy in states. There should be no state that doesn't have a real democracy. And I think we can't just let, you know, the Senate have had one losing vote on trying to pass these voting rights acts, voting rights measures. We have to push harder and harder for these senators to actually do their job and protect democracy in states. But then I go through in the book, there's so many other things we can do. We can't just wait for the Senate, you know, keep calling them. But if we sit around and wait for the Senate to save us, we're not doing many other things that we all can do. So the thing I'd ask your listeners to think about is, you know, and I did a whiteboard on this today. Like, look at what the incredible people of Ukraine are doing right now, stepping up to fight for their fledgling young democracy. There are accountants and taxi cab drivers and teachers, and they're all stepping up. Sadly, they're having to step up to fight a real war. But everyone in our country who cares for democracy can do a lot more than I think most imagine they can do to fight for democracy. We all should vote. We all should do jury duty when called. We all should help candidates that we support. But I think people can go way beyond that and have to, if we're going to get the scale of a pro-democracy movement we need. And I'll just put it this way for your listeners. Every one of us has a circle or footprint of influence in our lives. And we should be thinking, every one of us, what in our circle of influence can we do? What elements of that circle can we put to work for democracy? You know, as part of your job, do you work in a restaurant? Do you run a small business? Whatever it is you do, are there ways you could do your job or the organization you work with could do its job that lift democracy? You know, if you work in a restaurant, you know, Sherrod Brown, our senator, years ago, he convinced McDonald's to put a voter registration form as part of every menu on those old trays they would pass out. Is your restaurant that you work for doing that? Do you cut or style hair? Are you helping register your customers? If you're part of if you volunteer for a homeless shelter or food bank, is that homeless shelter or food bank, are they registering the people they serve who are often the people who aren't going to be voting or going to be knocked off the rolls through purging? How about your own social network? Do you happen to know the mayor of a town or a school board member? Are you asking them if they're lifting democracy? And what they do, every mayor of every city should be registering people wherever they have rec centers or libraries or health clinics. So I go through this in the book. There's so many concrete ways that everybody can make a difference to lift democracy, which we need to do. But my worry is a lot of people just haven't thought through all the different ways they could actually play such a role. And if I think that if everyone were to do that, we'd start to scale up the effort in a way that really makes a difference versus everyone waiting for sort of Stacey Abrams or Michelle Obama to somehow swoop into our states and save the day. I hope they do. But we all can play big roles in the meantime.
Well, just to not really to plug my personal website, jillcodyauthor.com, but there I do have a list of what everyday people can do, a list of ideas. So if people are asking themselves, what can I do? There's some information there. And, you know, my last question, I do have permission from Pettis to ask more questions this show. But do you think democracy is going to survive, David, in the 2 minutes we have, or 1.5 minutes?
Let me say, I do, but we're going to have to fight for it. It is not inevitable. The history of our country and other countries, and I think we're in a moment, and maybe this, what we're seeing in Ukraine wakes us up to this. We're in a moment where most people I'm 50, most people my age, a little older, a little younger, we haven't seen it really at risk, so we take it so for granted. But there are other eras where if you study at all, this is why I go through the history of the book, it is so, if attacked, democracy can founder, and it can be gone for generations. And so I think it can survive. I think I will say it will, but only if we all fight very hard. If we also have to recognize that what's happening in these state houses is not simply a voting rights change here or some law about history there. It's a much broader and coordinated attack on democracy itself. And if we don't recognize that and fight it in that way, that we see it for what it is, I do worry it could succeed. So it's late in the game. The other side that's then democracy does have a major head start. But I also still believe that the evidence is clear. If enough people wake up and fight for democracy, it can be saved. But I also don't think that's automatic. And I think we've been at a point in our country. I put this in the book. If we saw another country doing all the attacks on democracy that we see in our own states, we would actually call it out. But because we're so confident in our own states and our own country about democracy, we're like the frog in the pot.
That's boiling. Right.
We don't see it for what it is. We have to right away, and only then I think will we do all we need to do to fight to keep it from really being pulled under.
Well, I think we are witnessing a coup in real time, and my position is it started with Reagan and it's been happening for 40 years. David Pettis and I really enjoyed this conversation today. Thank you for being our bold and impressive guest, and I hope you'll come back sometime. I still have half of my questions still left to ask you. We appreciate you and your brilliant book, Laboratories of Autocracy, A Wake-Up Call from Behind the Lines. Thank you for writing such an exceptional book. This is a serious moment. And in my view, you have written about what may be democracy's silent killer. Thank you.
Thanks so much. Take care.
What's up next on Be Bold America? On Sunday, March 13th at 5 p.m., a friend of the program, Tom Hartman, will be returning to discuss his newest book, The Hidden History of Big Brother, How the Death of Privacy and the Rise of Surveillance Threatens Us and Our Democracy. Tom will talk about how most Americans are worried about how companies, like Facebook, invade their privacy and harvest their data, but that many people don't fully understand the details of how their information is being adapted and misused. Tom will also tell us how Big Brother invents whiteness to keep power, how the surveillance industry is booming, how democracy requires trust, and how authoritarianism requires fear, along with many other privacy topics. So join us on Sunday, March 13th at 5 p.m. to hear Tom Hartman discuss the consequences of big data on all aspects of our lives. Remember, Be Bold America is available as a podcast. Now you may listen to the show anytime for free wherever you get your podcasts. I want to give a special thank you to Be Bold America's program engineer, Emily Donham, to our station's program director, Howard Feldstein, and again to our bold guest, David Pepper. You're listening to KSQD Santa Cruz, Many Voices, One Station. Listen worldwide online at ksqd.org. Stay tuned for State of Mind with Deborah Sloss. My name is Jill Cody.
And I'm Dr. Pettis Perry.
And thank you for listening to Be Bold America. Until next time, keep, stop, start.